When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. Coming up, David Baddiel, the comedian and writer, discusses his relationship with faith and why believing in a higher power is something many of us strive for with mixed results. It's the topic of his recent book, The God Desire. And joining him on stage for this event, which was recorded earlier in 2023, were the comedian, actor and filmmaker Richard Ayoade and the theologian and broadcaster Ben Quash. And they had a conversation that tackled some of the ancient and fundamental questions, such as, is our need for there to be something greater than ourselves, anything more than just that, a need? This is the first in a three-part discussion. If you'd like to hear part two and three now, ad-free, then you can support our mission to foster honest debate and compelling conversation by heading to intelligencesquared.com/membership or by subscribing to our channel via Apple. Members also get access to our exclusive Bright Sparks quickfire interview with David Baddiel. Now let's join our host, Richard Ayoade, with more.
So I imagine many of you will know who David Baddiel is, but I'm going to introduce you.
Thanks.
From these bullet points. You're welcome. Comedian, author, screenwriter, television presenter, 1992, performed in the UK's first ever arena comedy show at Wembley. Starred in the Mary Whitehouse Experience, Newman and Baddiel and Pieces, Fantasy Football. Sorry, the energy's tailing off.
Yeah.
But that's a structural problem with me rather than your career.
Okay.
He has created and presented several acclaimed documentaries. He's written 10 successful children's books, as well as 4 acclaimed adult novels. His last book, Jews Don't Count, was the Sunday Times Political and Current Affairs Book of the Year in 2021. And last year, it was adapted into a documentary for Channel 4. The new book is The God Desire. Ben Quash is the Professor of Christianity and the Arts at King's College London, a frequent broadcaster on BBC Radio. A particular interest in how the arts can renew people's engagement with the Bible and Christian tradition. He is the author of the books Found Theology, Abiding, and was co-editor of the book Heresies and How to Avoid Them. And he is the director of the VCS, the Visual Commentary on Scripture, a curated ongoing online exhibition that puts work of art in dialogue. I'm Richard Ayoade. I used to be in the IT crowd. Why am I sandwiched between such eminence? Well, David asked me, so I must thank you, David. And also I must thank my wife, Lydia, because she was taught by Ben, first as an undergraduate and recently doing masters. And she suggested when Ben, when David kindly asked me to do this, that I ought to immediately ask someone far more intelligent and distinguished than me to make up for my shortcomings. So thank you both for being here, and I can only apologize in advance. So the first thing I'd like to ask David is, why did you write this book? What is it roughly about?
Okay. Well, I might read a bit from it to explain what it's about. Why I wrote it is I wrote a book, as you mentioned, called Jews Don't Count, which I was asked to write by the Times Literary Supplement. I wasn't specifically asked to write that book. I was asked to write an essay book. They had this idea, which is quite a good idea, I think, to try and revive a literary tradition, which is sort of Orwell used to write books that were quite short, that were probably polemical, that had an element of pamphlet to them. And so he would take a particular thought that he had had on language and politics, whatever it might be, and he would write, he would write like 100 pages or 80 pages about it. And they wanted to revive that tradition, and they said you could write about whatever you like. So I wrote about how, in my opinion, Jews are kind of downgraded in the identity politics conversation. And then that book did all right, and they asked me to write another one. And I think what they really wanted was a sequel. They wanted me to write Jews Still Don't Count.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to do that, because I thought, well, I'll do that when my career's going worse. And so I thought, what else am I sort of deeply engaged with? What else do I give quite a lot of thought to? And it was, for me, it was atheism, but my particular type of atheism, which in a way follows on from Jews Don't Count, because in Jews Don't Count, obviously, I talk a lot about being Jewish, but I also talk about something very specific in that. There's a moment in that which turned out to be what I thought would be obvious, but is not. I thought it would be on the nursery slopes of that conversation, yeah. Which is that anti-Semitism is racism. And the way I illustrate that anti-Semitism is racism and not religious intolerance is by saying I'm an atheist, but that would get me no free passes out of Auschwitz. And that turned out to be something of a breakthrough for a lot of people who hadn't understood that about anti-Semitism. And then I thought, well, I could probably follow on about what it means to be a Jewish atheist, and to do that I need to outline why I'm an atheist, and the book does that, and yep. Perhaps I should now read a
yep,
bit
that
to,
sounds
to
good.
Give
yeah.
a sense of it. So this is quite early on in the book. Actually, to explain this bit, I'll just read out the two epigraphs at the start, which I chose very late on in the book when I thought, oh, it should probably have some epigraphs. Before the divine kingdom can be established in events, it has to be established in the mind, in the human imagination. Bishop Richard Harris, Thought for the Day, BBC Radio 4, 4th of November 2022. And we cherish the illusion that exalts us more than a host of baser truths, by Alexander Pushkin. And then on page 5, I say, when you write a book, you spend a fair bit of time thinking about the epigraph. In truth, it's probably procrastination. Writing a book is hard, whereas decorating a book, choosing a cover, blurbs, epigrams, is not, comparatively. I chose two quotes, which you may have just read. I like those two. They are, I think, apposite. But the one I really wanted to use was this. A close friend once said to me, but don't you want to believe in God? I said, yes, desperately. That's why I know he doesn't exist. It's the opening sentence of The Belief System, a book by an atheist thinker, Virginia Brooke. But Virginia Brooke is a character of my own devising who appears in my own play, God's Dice. And using one of my own quotes as an epigraph is just too naff. I thought I might be able to get away with it on the basis that this book is about the non-existence of something. So perhaps it would be apt to begin with a quote from a book that doesn't exist. I thought that might be meta and clever enough to carry it through. But in the end, it's just too Alan Partridge a move. Nonetheless, the quote does sit at the center of this polemic. Most arguments for atheism are philosophical. Sometimes they tie themselves in knots, grappling with the issue of how you can prove the non-existence of something. At heart, they are based on the idea that there is no evidence for God's existence, therefore he doesn't exist. My argument, on the other hand, is in a general sense psychological. It requires an admission, which frankly most atheists I've noticed aren't prepared to make, which is, I love God, the idea, that is, of him. For the purpose of this polemic, I'm going to stick with the patriarchal traditional pronoun, although I believe a modern God would almost definitely have a Twitter bio that ended they stroke them. Who would not love a superhero dad who chases off death? Some non-believers reading this will think, speak for yourself. It's common amongst atheists in trashing religion also to trash the rewards of religion. Or to be more specific, to disavow the presence in themselves of what religion is there to serve. There is something a little macho in atheism. Some atheists divine, correctly, that what religion provides for human beings is comfort. And then, in a way that can feel a bit adolescent, they feel impelled to say, essentially, comfort, that's for babies. But humans, a subset of which includes all atheists, are babies. However old and intellectual and cynical they grow, no matter how adult and controlled we seem on the surface, Underneath, we are a hive of wailing, impulsive, immediate need. I'm happy to admit to my own babyishness. That might be because, or rather why, I am a comedian. Much comedy is just that, stripping away the facade of adulthood. We are all winging adulthood, truly. There is only one adult in the world whose age in his soul lines up with the age he in fact is, and his name is Michael Gove. I am flawed and shallow and scared and often desperately in need of comfort, both psychological and physical. I am, however, someone with enough self-awareness to perceive these as urges rather than ideas. My thinking self, in other words, is distinct from my urgent one. Not all the time. I often find myself thinking, I must eat now or I will die, even when it's only 11 in the morning. But I'm conscious, even as I think it, that this isn't a logical way to understand the world or even the phenomenon of feeling peckish. I know, even as I experience desire, that it is desire and that desire provides no frame for reality. The God desire should not have to lead to the God delusion. Yet the desire is real. For me, it is the very intensity of it which alerts me to the fact of fantasy. The need to imagine that there is an exit door, somewhere through which to escape constantly oncoming death, is one that I can confidently predict exists within the deep recesses of most humans. And the pressure of that desire has always and will always lead to divine projection. People talk a lot about what it means to be human, about what separates us from the animals. Some of that is lyrical. Love and empathy and stuff. I personally think it can be pinned down to the fact that we are the only animals who feel shame in defecating. But whether it makes us human or not, we are the only animal that from an early age is aware of the inevitability of death. So it is impossible to look at the repetitive creation of legends across every culture and throughout history, which in one way or another outsmart death and promise immortality, without concluding that God is a projection of a very fundamental desire within us for it not to be so inevitable. So that's what it's about. It's about how much I feel the desire that I think in a mass psychology way has led to the creation of God as an idea in many different forms. And this desire is served by many different types of God and not just the traditional Judeo-Christian God. And also it's not just death. It's also about meaning, about storifying life, about providing some kind of order to life, some kind of justice to life. All those things are served by God. And I feel those things. I feel the need for those things as much as anyone else. And the feeling of that need is what leads me to my atheism.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Okay, good. Now I'm going to ask for Ben's response to the book when you read it, and also to the question of desire and what it means to desire God in terms of your understanding with regards to David's book.
First of all, I want to say thank you to David for writing it. And the fact that most bookshops don't stock any books in theology these days at all, except very specialized ones, means that I rejoice that a book that's actually doing theology in lots of ways, in the sense that it's raising big questions about the nature of the world, the kind of world we live in, and what it is to live in it well, honestly, and to address questions like love and so on. This is the sort of terrain of theology. And unfortunately, what you normally get in bookshops is a little small not even a whole bookshelf sometimes, but a few shelves that just called religion. And religion is not the same as theology.
Mm.
Religion is the study of a set of human practices over time, more of a sort of social science type of activity. And theology is about what you're doing. It's about these sorts of profoundly engaging questions we care about, orient the way we live. So thank you for getting theology out in this form. As a theologian, I'm really grateful. And I also think it's you call it a polemic, but it's actually a very sort of generous and quite vulnerable book.
Yeah, it's not really a polemic.
It's not a polemic.
No.
And so I really enjoyed that aspect of it too, and particularly the personal bits.
I think I wrote the word polemic quite early on, and then forgot to change it. Yeah, forgot to change
okay.
it. Yeah.
Well, that's great.
That's difficult. So we're dealing with the first draft.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
I know it's in a book, but I should have revised that.
I understand.
That,
yeah.
So I really want to also celebrate the fact that it's about something much more interesting than the existence of God, which, as you say in the book, and Alain de Botton has said elsewhere, in a way is often a very boring and unproductive question.
Yeah.
So I hope we won't spend much time on that tonight. I think the question of desire and the desire for God is really interesting. And I suppose my first response in reading it was to wonder, to actually be led to a quite intense form of self-examination about whether...
Has no one heard a word I've been saying?
Okay. I hope you have.
Good.
Yeah, should we start again?
Look, this is fine. The first row heard everything.
Yeah.
Just all people online and people beyond the first row have no idea.
Yeah.
I think, have people heard?
Did you hear?
Oh. Yeah.
Okay, good.
I think that was one of the most passive-aggressive mic hands I've ever...
Also,
he could have just said, speak up.
He could have done. And also, if anyone was going to create a technical problem tonight, it would be God. So... Well. I just have to accept that's
okay.
probably going on.
Yes. Well, you know, he's a bad roadie.
Yeah.
Now that you're clearly the lead singer, let's go on.
Yeah.
I found myself having to ask whether I agreed with you on the huge importance you give to death as a sort of definitive. It's partly doing the explanatory job of accounting for why we have the desire. It's because of death that we have this desire. And also clearly in your own biography figures very centrally in your relationship with the idea of God. And the reason it's a difficult question to ask is because one can easily be self-deluding about this. But I don't find death as much of an issue as I think you do. And in some ways, I have a sense that if I can get to the end of my life and not have done anything too terrible,
right,
I'll feel a certain relief about it. So death, in a way, sort of stands for drawing stumps and, you know, quite apart from questions of the afterlife, you know, I hope I won't have really cocked it up.
Right.
And also, I quite like anesthetics. The few times I've been in hospital, I quite like that sense of brief oblivion.
When do you like it?
When
you wake up.
When I wake up, yeah. Okay, good point. Thank you.
Okay. But on that, Ingmar Bergman once had an operation, and this isn't a great story so far, but he had an operation, and he spent his life anguished by a judgmental God, a rather severe Lutheran father, and he said the relief of his having consciousness and then it stopping was the most thrilling thing that had happened to him at that point. Just that judgment had gone, and that there was no one pointing the finger, and that it just stopped.
Mm.
And he felt that gave him a kind of confidence.
Yeah, I mean, that's a judgment or a something he's coming to from the point of view of consciousness. You know, he can only make that sense of like, oh,
He had a
that.
Secretary just before he nodded off, and
she
just said, of course, it's from the point of view of consciousness, but it's an experience of non-consciousness and a comfortable being comfortable with the prospect of non-consciousness in the future as well.
Okay, but, well, I should perhaps explain something. So two things. One is the individual experience you're talking about, the book actually begins with, or just before the bit I read, which is it begins by talking about how my mum, when I was sort of 6 or 7 years old, and I'd first understood that we die, and I'd first got that as a realization, which obviously we all come to, I'd sort of tried to talk to her about it because I was frightened. And she said, oh, don't worry, it's like a long sleep from which you never wake up. Now, some people may know this about me, but I'm an insomniac. And I think that's when that kicked in, because I like sleeping. Mm. I love sleeping. Sleeping's great when I achieve it. But I think my love of sleeping is a lot to do with the knowledge that I'm going to wake up. And by the way, when I, you know, a few people have said this to me, that, oh, you know, I'm not frightened of death, kind of in the way that you seem to be in the book. And I totally accept that. So someone said to me the other day that Joan Bakewell had been talking about being 91 and sort of looking forward to death. And on an individual basis, I can obviously see that to be the case. What I'm talking about here is a mass psychology, the way that cultures in general will create a legend to outsmart death and to, you know, all sorts of other things that it will do as well. It will explain and find ways through all sorts of other things that seem to the culture like this is not how I want things to be, or and I don't understand this, and I don't like this encroaching darkness or this encroaching earthquake or whatever else it might be. So basically, it doesn't need to be an individual sense in which I can understand. I mean, as an individual, Ingmar Bergman or you might think like, no, I quite like the idea of sort of unconsciousness, but I don't believe that that negates the idea that as cultures we have tried to find ways around death. So many stories are about resurrection.
Yeah.
And why are they about resurrection? Yeah. Why indeed at the basis of Christian prayer, you'll have to tell me the exact prayer, but it's like, it's, what is it? It's something in the funeral service about how death will be vanquished. Mm. The vanquishing of death is at the heart of many, many religious ideas. And why should that be?
Mm. Yeah.
Well, I suppose, you, as you say, your book starts with this image of your mother reassuring you, failing to reassure you about death. And I suppose in one way, I suppose saying it's not going to be painful or frightening. And in some way, it's going to be gentle. So I guess it brings up the question of finitude, which we were talking about earlier. And to what extent is... would you call it a fear in culture, or your fear, or your fear which you see occurring more widely, which is of one's own consciousness ending, of life being finite?
Yeah.
How much of that plays into your desire for God as something that stops your own finitude?
Oh, I think that for me, that's key. And it's, I mean, I mentioned in the book something that atheists say. I think I quote Bertrand Russell, and Dawkins has said the same thing. Bertrand Russell said quite famously that he would scorn to the idea of shivering at his own oblivion.
Yeah.
He's scornful about the idea that you should be frightened of oblivion. Now, there's two things going on there. Number one is, again, this atheist machismo. It's like, all these fairy tales that people need to make up in order to comfort themselves from the ideas of whatever they're frightened of, principally death, but all sorts of things they're frightened of. I, the great atheist, have no need of this. I don't believe that. Yeah. I think that's a pose that a lot of atheists take in order to feel kind of grown up and proper and big. But there's something else going on there, which is, I think Dawkins has said a similar thing, but not quite as lofty a way as Russell, which is that why should you be frightened of death? Because you won't know you're dead. And that seems very logical. But it's deeply, for me, inhuman, because you're only saying that from the point of view of life. And from the point of view of life, I promise you, life seems a lot fucking better. It really does. Like, some people in here might think, well, I find life so difficult or whatever that I find the idea of nothingness sort of more attractive. But I think that's unlikely. I think that one of the things about the book is it's...
I mean, I was born in Ipswich, so...
Well,
we have to relativize this.
I, when my mum was talking to me, I was living in Dollis Hill in 1973. So I can tell you that, as I say in the book, was a kind of death. But I think the book is powered, and I quote John Updike quite a lot in the book. John Updike, yes. Who is my favourite writer and who was a Christian and deeply believed in God. But I think what I share with Updike, Updike had an almost hysterical but beautifully written attachment to life. Like he was so, like he, a late book by Updike is called Terrorist. It's like a lot of Updike books, it's not that good. But what it's about a suicide bomber. And you might ask, why is John Updike writing about a suicide bomber? I think it's because he got old and he thought, I need to write about someone who is in love in the way that I am with life, with death. I need to somehow manage the idea of death and create the love that I feel for life throughout death. He calls life this complex interval of light, which I think is so beautiful. And I think that that's, you know, the book, if it has a sort of positive energy, because it might sound a bit deathy the way that we're talking about it, but the positive energy is a deep commitment and love of whatever life may hold, even though life holds lots of shit things. Mm. It's still, for me, better than oblivion. Mm. And I think that exists deeply in all of us, even if we might buy into what I think is a slightly religious thing of, well, there's a sort of serenity and finitude.
Can I just come, because I think that that idea of an interval of light is fascinating. I mean, it actually reminds me of the Venerable Bede, the kind of great early British theologian, who I think tells the story of a sparrow flying into a feasting hall through one window and out the other. And he says that's an image of life, you know, this brief moment where from the cold and the dark, you're briefly in this place of noise, music, laughter, and light, and then out again. But it seems to me that part of the conditions for being able to celebrate and enjoy that interval is that it's finite. So there's a curious way in which death is the necessary bookend to all the good things that one enjoys. And a healthy, this is true for anyone, whether religious or not, that a kind of healthy relationship to one's own death becomes a condition for a properly celebratory way of living now.
Yeah.
And without death, and the idea that somehow your life could just stretch on and on, it would cease to be a joyous thing at all.
Of course. Yeah. But what you're talking now is a kind of like, you know, nice, almost humanist, logical way of thinking about death. The creation of God comes from a much, much deeper psychological soup that is nothing to do with, well, obviously, I mean, I agree with you. Obviously, life would start to become exhausting and meaningless and weird if you just lived forever. It wouldn't work. Mm. That doesn't mean you don't want it.
Yeah.
Because wants and desires come from a much more complex, unsayable, not logical place than worked out in your head. Like, oh, yeah, that wouldn't actually be very nice to live forever. Of course it wouldn't.
Yes, the only thing, though, is that, well, you've written a book, which is logical and worked out and put in those terms, but about psychology. So it's not necessarily the case, or from a psychological sense of why I might desire this. So they're perhaps not in opposition, the idea of something that is worked out and rational and desirous.
Yes, I don't actually completely agree with that. There's a bit in the book where I talk about how God is also, like, it's not just about death. I think God is also, and I use Updike this, Updike talks about how he also it's a bit about sleep as well, and he imagines humanity as kind of the child in bed being comforted by the sounds downstairs, comforted by knowing that your parents are downstairs. And he talks about how that sort of creates the idea that there must be something beyond, there must be gods, there must be people watching over us. And that mustness, that imperative, is his reason for why there is a God. And it's my reason for why there isn't. Let me just explain something else.
Yes,
to answer your question.
I'm going to get the end of Pigeon Feathers ready.
Oh, yeah, well, Pigeon Feathers is fantastic. But one of the things is that I also talk about God as not just being a way of outsmarting death, but also a way of providing this parent figure. And again, it's not as simple as, like, it's just a caring parent. You know, I don't want to get all Freudian on it, but the way that we might, if we were to unconsciously project a parent figure that is always there for us, they would also be angry. They would also be hateful. They would also be difficult. We would also have to be constantly doing things for them that might not match up to what we wanted, because what we are in the unconscious is a soup of anxiety and desire. But I wasn't going to call it the God Anxiety and Desire, because that's a shit title.
Okay. Well, that can be the sequel, okay, of course. Well,
That may explain... Cause one of the things that really interests me as well is that there was a theologian, a 20th century German theologian, who then moved to America called Paul Tillich, and...
Yeah.
He described you come across.
No, I haven't, except in the writings of John Updike.
Okay, he's in Updike. Tillich. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm. And Tillich describes three different things that, it's a very broad brush sort of meta narrative that probably we ought to be suspicious of. But he describes three different points in Christian history in the 2000 years where people look to God to sort out three different anxieties. And death was the first one, interestingly. So lots of early Christian art is centered on the idea of conquest of death, the triumph over death. And the sorts of things that are depicted in art are often moments of victory. And it's either the devil or some sort of visualization of death as a monster or whatever being defeated.
Yeah.
And then in the time of the Reformation, it's sin. And so what God does is sort out not so much death, but the problem of sin, because people are really worried about that.
Yeah.
And then he suggests that the modern, big modern anxiety is meaninglessness. And you, as you've said in summarizing the book, in a way you deal with the first and the third. And there's a sort of interesting hole there in the middle about the sin one.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. And it's interesting that I have to bring in Frank Skinner at this point, because I tell this story. I tell this story about how when I first met Frank, I didn't realize how devout and how literal a Catholic Frank was. And we went on a long car journey, and he was explaining to me something very specific, which I think I'm going to tell you because it's in its mechanics, because the mechanics interest me. So Frank at the time had left his wife, and he was living, I think he'd actually got divorced, and he was living with his girlfriend, and he was having sex with his girlfriend. Now that, in the Catholic Church, is adultery, right? And he was explaining this to me, that what this meant was that he couldn't go to confession, because to get confession, you have to confess your sin and then promise not to do it anymore, at which point you get absolution, and then you can take communion, right? And he's explaining this to me over about an hour and a half, because I don't really understand it. And at the end of it, I get out the car at Birmingham New Street Station, and I say to him, sorry, why are you bothered about all this? And he said, no, you don't understand. I think I will burn in hellfire because of this. And I literally had never heard anyone say that. You know, I don't live in 1605. I'd never heard anyone say that and really mean it. And I was really kind of impressed at some level. I didn't think, thus he's an idiot. I thought that's incredibly impressive that he really, really feels that. Mm. That makes him more interesting. I'd only just met him. More interesting a person than I thought. But what it does mean in terms of what you're saying, and that's probably true, is because I come from, I guess, a Jewish background, and obviously the book is quite Talmudic at some level, Jews don't have much of a conception of an afterlife. And the judgment that is going on for Jews, for Orthodox Jews, and by the way, there are 613 mitzvot, which are things you're meant to be doing all the time as a Jew. As far as I can make out, it's a kind of OCD thing where you've got to kind of wrap something around your head or turn off a light or not eat this bit of pork or whatever the fuck it is. And what those people, where that comes from, the anxiety and primordial soup that comes from, is anxiety about judgment in this life. And that comes, and I should have said this in the book, this is all kind of interesting, I wish I'd put this in the book, anyway, second edition, that comes from being a persecuted minority. Mm. That comes from the sense that people are going to do bad things to you all the time, and you can't really do anything about it, but maybe if you do all these weird things all the time, they will shield you from it. Mm. But what I don't have, I think, is a sense, which you've sort of mentioned, of the idea of judgment in the life to come. And so maybe that is why I've missed that out, because I guess, yes, if you are really frightened in a genuine way of judgment in the life to come, oblivion may seem preferable. I don't think it really makes much difference to my sense that God is still a creation of desire and anxiety.
It's just another
type of anxiety.
I suppose part of the question is whether that is as primordial a part of all human experience as the fear of death is, and or whether part of what... You know, you've characterized as some of the differences between Judaism and Christianity might suggest that there are more sort of historically inflected circumstances in which some kinds of anxiety dominate. And I guess that's Tillich's point. So it might not be as universal. You know, there might be more sort of more variety in the historical contexts and the cultural and religious contexts in which people need God for different things. So, you know, there may be something that's less primordial, in
and
other words.
Maybe it's interesting to talk about, I guess, desire and what I guess what we mean by desire, what you mean by desire, how I guess you've alluded to the idea that it's perhaps not entirely conscious.
Yeah.
To what degree do you choose what you desire? As Updike, I think, said, I chose to believe in God.
Yes.
That he made that consciously, and C.S. Lewis would say, if your rationality gets in the way of your faith, then don't have it, as in it has to involve your rationality. But so I guess my question is, how do you know what you're desiring? Is it by seeing what your life is like and go, oh, I can back sort of reverse engineer from what it seems to be I'm projecting? How can you tell what your desires are, I suppose, I'm saying? And this isn't a come-on.
No. that's a really good question, I think, because I think in the book I am retro-engineering. I am looking at what I think God does in terms of what he serves in the human psyche, and I'm retro-engineering and saying, okay, well, these are things that I feel, which is I am frightened of death, I am frightened of meaninglessness, I sort of wish there was a more universal justice, and I also, beyond that, and that's more psychoanalytical, have a sense that, yeah, there's all these anxieties and unknown things. So desire as a, if one is to be Freudian about it, desire would always be something that you might not be able to completely name and identify.
Yeah.
So I am assuming in writing about the God desire that some of those desires might be at the forefront of your head and some of them will be almost unnameable. And that is partly why I think the imagination of God isn't just a straightforward thing, and it certainly isn't just straightforwardly a good, nice thing,
right.
I think. Because I think we're trying to play out all sorts of things that might come under the headline of desire. But I wouldn't be able to say you can name all of them.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay with editing from Tom Hall. If you'd like to hear the full extended version right now, then head over to intelligencesquared.com to sign up and become a member. We'd also love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.